We are now going to update Shikarchi AG directly on the rebroadcast of the original March 12, 1989 addendum to Radio Free America 34. I'm going to very quickly summarize what it is we're going to be putting into this particular addendum. And what we're going to be doing is we're going to be, first of all, adding to the list of names from the Iran-Contra scandal that hook up with the Pizza Connection case and, consequently, the Shikarchi AG case, because obviously, as we've seen, they intersect tremendously. We're going to take a look at the names Richard Secord, Willard Zucker, and Albert Hakim, all coming up in connection with Shikarchi AG, or Shikarchi, I'm not sure how it's pronounced. Next, we're going to take a look at an article which is going to review much of the information that we heard, and is also going to talk about the bomb assassination of Rocco Chinnici, one of the first judges investigating the Shikarchi AG case and related cases. And then we're going to talk about an almost identical attempt, fortunately unsuccessful, on the life of Judge Falcone. We're also going to review information about the Rudolf Gerber connection, the CIA connection, the Avni Yasser Musalulu connection, a.k.a. Oral Chalik, etc. And then we're going to take a look at some speculation. It has not been established, but some speculation that, in fact, the perpetrator or a possible perpetrator of the unsuccessful attempt on Judge Falcone's life may have been a person who was being investigated by Judge Carlo Palermo in the Pizza Connection, in the Stibom case that we've talked about earlier. And if we have time, we'll see how it goes. If not, we'll work it on next week. I'm going to read some information from L'Espresso. I'm going to talk about more concerning the Bush administration and the intersection with the P2 Lodge, etc. In any event, this first section, though, is going into the archives as an addendum to the Shikarchi AG case. Research credit for all of these articles and translations goes to Dave, who is doing his characteristically excellent work. And this first article comes from the Swiss American Review of January 25th of 1989. And we find this small section. Three persons whose names appear in the Irangate framework, Richard Secord, Albert Hakim, and Willard Zucker, deposited money in the 80s through Shikarchi trading in Zurich, according to Sontag's Blick, S-O-N-N-T-A-G-S, capital B-L-I-C-K. So we now see the names Secord, which we saw before, as well as Albert Hakim and Willard Zucker, major participants in the Shikarchi AG, obviously firming up the connection between the players in the Iran-Contra scandal and Shikarchi AG. Shikarchi AG appears to be where the Pizza Connection case meets the Iran-Contra scandal and Stibom. More, reviewing not only the assassination by bomb of Judge Rocco Chinnici, who was investigating the Pizza Connection and other material, and Avni Yasser Musalulu, and we're going to take a look at how he was assassinated and the similarity between his assassination and another attempt on Judge Falcone, who picked up his investigation. Research and translation credit for the following story goes to Dave, our Italian translator. This is from L'Espresso of July 2nd of 1989. March of 1983, at Zurich Courthouse. On the Swiss magistrate's table, a letter arrives from Palermo. It's a request for assistance, as is said in legal slang, signed by Rocco Chinnici, last name C-H-I-N-N-I-C-I, investigating counselor. Chinnici is looking into the Pizza Connection and some Swiss financial institutions suspected of recycling narco dollars. At the heart of the investigation is an international mafia boss, Avni Sari Musalulu, a Turkish national who lives and works in Switzerland with offices on the Bahnhofstrasse. 6 months later, Chinnici is assassinated by a remote control bomb. January 1989, Zurich again, the same courthouse. Investigating magistrate Giovanni Falcone arrives, the number one enemy of the mafia, the magistrate who's inherited Chinnici's case and inquiries. The same subject and the same personages. Against Musalulu, the Sicilian judge signs an arrest warrant. Okay, so he's basically trying to arrest Oral Chalik, who has the notation under his mugshot, do not arrest. Continuing with the account, we arrive at last week, Wednesday, June 14th, Palermo. Agents of the escort service discover another bomb, the same kind, remote control, placed on the rocks in front of the small seaside house rented by Judge Falcone. It was supposed to have exploded at 2 p.m. on the preceding day. The judge recounted, quote, I'd gone there to go swimming, but I'd never make it to the seaside. With only one exception, I had to accompany some foreign colleagues to visit the cliffs at the end of Palermo. It was this exception that remained to be exploited. The foreign colleagues of whom Falcone speaks are Swiss. They were in Sicily to exchange information on the international recycling of narco dollars. Coincidence? Not on your life. The same Palermitan magistrate confirms it. The attempt is linked to important judicial initiatives that remain to be taken on the matter of recycling. Falcone prefers, for obvious reasons of preliminary secrecy, not to specify, but everyone is left to think that he's referring to an inquiry that has international ramifications, and that has its focus on Shikarchi AG, the Lebanese financial institutions with headquarters in Zurich. The firm, for years under fire for recycling, the firm, for years under fire for recycling 1.6 billion francs, more than 1.3 billion lira, earned from heroin sales in the famous Pizza Connection, was only recently placed under indictment by Swiss justice because of pressures exerted on Bern by the DEA. Among Shikarchi's clients, according to a report compiled by the Nucleo Antidroga of the Guardia di Finanza, was Avni Sari Musululu, the Turkish trafficker first pursued by Chinichi and now by Falcone. A personage is in many circles, this Musululu. Interpol wants him for arms trafficking and armed banditry, and who had investigated him always for the arms traffic? The judge, Carlo Palermo. Another coincidence. The magistrate, transferred from Trent to Trapani, was the victim of an attack from which he narrowly escaped, a car bomb that killed a mother and two babies, operated by remote control. Interrupting, we went on, we covered that attempt on Judge Palermo's life at near the end of Radio Free America number 20 about Stibom. Resuming the narrative, at the end of last year, the official fugitive Musululu, living peacefully in Geneva, was accidentally discovered by Turkish journalist Erdin Spartali, last name S-P-A-R-T-A-L-I. Strange thing, when Spartali goes to tell the Swiss gendarme, he's bluntly ordered to give a wide berth if he wants to keep his tourist's visa. It then comes out that on the Interpol wanted notice describing the dangerous individual, unquote, the main office in Bern had purposely stamped Nicht verhaften, ne pas arrête, do not arrest, that obviously in German and French. That last sentence once again. It then comes out that on the Interpol wanted notice describing the dangerous individual, quote-unquote, the main office in Bern had purposely stamped, quote, Nicht verhaften, ne pas arrête, do not arrest. The inevitable controversy breaks out. It comes out, for example, that the vice president of the Lebanese financial institution is the lawyer Hans Kopp, husband of Elizabeth Kopp, the head of the Justice Department and Swiss police. She's forced to resign, but leaves slamming the door, quote, Shikarchi is an irreproachable financial institution, she hisses angrily. What a pity for her that 10 days later the federal chancellery in Bern issued a bulletin in which it's revealed that, quote, into a Shikarchi account in the United States was paid $500,000 originating from a cocaine traffic, unquote. And that's not all. One learns that Mohammed Shikarchi, also Lebanese, had substantial investments in the Republic National Bank of New York. And one learns that since at least 1981, the bank was collaborating with the CIA. That, of course, is Shikarchi. But the strangeness of this international affair doesn't end here. A few days ago, the Zurich solicitor's office tried to defend itself against charges of connivance and protection of those who helped the narco-traffickers. It's thus emerged that, as a result of a request for assistance in August of 1986 by Turin magistrate Mario Vadono, Zurich police had prepared a report in which they'd quoted the names of the biggest drug traffickers connected to the Pizza Connection. Also among them, the Turk Irfan Parlak, I-R-F-A-N-P-A-R-L-A-K, a Zurich resident since 1983, who'd naturally had business dealings with Shikarchi. Despite the conclusions of this report, no proceedings were opened against the Turk. The current accounts of Parlak and Shikarchi, which had been frozen at first, were quickly unfrozen. The Pizza Connection, recycling, and Shikarchi aren't the only threads leading to Switzerland. On October 14, 1988, Oliviero Tognoli, T-O-G-N-O-L-I, a Brescian industrialist sought for more than 4 years, was arrested at Lugano Airport. A few hours later, Giovanni Falcone phoned the assistant prosecutor's office and congratulated his colleague Carlo Del Ponte. Tognoli is regarded as a cashier of the Sicilian narco-traffic. At 2:05 p.m. last Tuesday, the Palermo magistrate and his Swiss colleagues Del Ponte and Lehman were discussing this. That's why Falcone was late to his office bunker and didn't return to his seaside house. The following afternoon, when the pyrotechnists opened the bag containing 23 kilos of TNT, they noticed that the timer was set at 2:05. Coincidence? Well, obviously, it doesn't look like coincidence here. The point being that the first person who defied the orders stamped on Avni Yasser Musululu, a.k.a. Oral Chalik's wanted poster, basically said, do not arrest. Well, the first person who tried to prosecute him, Judge Chinichi, was killed by a remote control bomb. Judge Falcone, who picked up his investigation, narrowly escaped assassination by a similar device. And another person who was involved in investigating some of these same people and the same milieu, namely Judge Carlo Palermo, who looked into the Stibom arms for drugs case, he narrowly missed assassination by a similar kind of bomb. Now, interestingly enough, the name of another Turk who was investigated by Carlo Palermo has surfaced in connection with this bomb attack, although it's by no means a firm connection at this point. It's simply food for thought and grounds for further research. Research credit for the following article, again, goes to Dave, our Italian translator. This is from the Corriere della Sera of August 12, 1989. It reads in part, is Hanifi Arslan, A-R-S-L-A-N, the Turk who connects Ferrara to Palermo? If the infamous Turk is Arslan, he's 47 years old, an arms and drugs trafficker already investigated by Judge Carlo Palermo and as experienced as few are in handling explosives. He's in demand by everyone, even the mafia. Some say, perhaps, even by the people who organized the attempt on Judge Falcone. Arslan is probably the Turk described by the former vice brigadier imprisoned in Ferrara, Osvaldo Massari. Quote, in 1982, the chief figure of the cocaine connection revealed to Judge Pavone of Venice, my band helped it. Let me see, we're starting. In 1982, the chief figure of the cocaine connection revealed to Judge Pavone of Venice, my band helped a Turkish mafioso escape from Trent prison in exchange for 20 kilos of cocaine. So it goes on to say that it's possible that this Turk Arslan, also involved in Judge Palermo's Stibom investigation, may have been involved in the attempt on Judge Falcone. It's by no means clear, and the article makes that clear in parts further down, but it's interesting to see that his name crops up in connection with it. It will also be interesting to see whether that connection pans out in a hard way or whether it sort of dies on the vine and turns out to be either a false lead or an uninvestigated or unprosecuted lead. Now, again, the reason why the Pizza Connection 4 bust has to have been so very, very important is because of all of the connections that could have emerged if that case unraveled as far as it could have. I'm not going to go into that now because, again, listeners on this 10th day of December of 1989 have already heard some of the archive tapes, and so it's not necessary for me at this point, I think, to go back and review all of that information as complicated as it is. But it's worth taking note of these various connections between the United States, between P2, between the Italian Mediterranean merry-go-round and the Reagan-Bush administration, and it's interesting to see just how much could come out if these connections were to emerge as they might have. The following article, also researched and translated by Dave, is from L'Espresso of October 8th of 1989, and it reads, a recording tape divided into two parts. In the first part, a harsh voice in which an Italian with a heavy foreign accent announces, quote, they will reveal some secrets of the Italian Republic, unquote. With this tape begins the latest disquieting mystery connected to Licio Gelli, the P2 head out on bail, in spite of a 10-year sentence for the Bologna massacre. From this tape unravels the matter that culminated with the, quote, repentance, unquote, of Bologna's lawyer Roberto Montorzi, M-O-N-T-O-R-Z-I, for years the lawyer for the civil parties and the great prosecutor of Gelli now sided with the Grand Master against the judges who prosecuted and sentenced him. Interrupting, Roberto Montorzi had been the attorney for the civil plaintiffs in the Bologna case, and he then switched around and went pro-Gelli, I guess you could say, instead of against him. Returning to the narrative, we return to the tape and to the secrets contained within. Here's a sample. The recycling of dirty money from a great Italian financier through the Bank of Boston. The connection between the Bologna massacre of August 2, 1980, and the Ustica air disaster, which occurred about a month earlier, the source of the information that reached the economist Romano Prodi on the place, Via Gradoli, where Aldo Moro had been held prisoner. Interrupting again, Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister of Italy, was held prisoner by the Red Brigades and assassinated by them, just as he was planning to incorporate the Italian Communist Party into the political process in Italy. Now, the available evidence suggests very strongly that the Red Brigades are in fact agents provocateurs run by the Italian far right in order to discredit the left. Returning to the narrative. In the second part of the tape, the talking passes over to Licio Gelli in person. The Grand Master talks at random about various subjects. This cassette has a history where mystery comes on top of mystery. The cassette had been kept in the office of the lawyer Montorzi, who'd quit his job July 20th after a meeting with Gelli. Now the cassette is no more because someone in the middle of June stole it. Montorzi had gotten it from Cristiano Ravarino, R-A-V-A-R-I-N-O, a strange figure in political journalism, the author of the meeting between Gelli and Montorzi in Via Wanda Arezzo. And this fellow Cristiano Ravarino, the person who gave this explosive tape containing secrets to Montorzi, he is the key fellow in our story here. Cristiano Ravarino. Repeating the last sentence again, Montorzi had gotten it, that's the tape, from Cristiano Ravarino, a strange figure in political journalism, the author of the meeting between Gelli and Montorzi in Via Wanda, Arezzo. So is also this Cristiano Ravarino who arranged for Gelli and Montorzi to meet. And who'd given the cassette to Ravarino? Quote, they sent it from Miami, where I often receive interesting papers and documents. Unquote. At the source of everything, there's that strange personage who answers to the name of Cristiano Ravarino. Who is he really? Where does he come from? Ravarino is American. Since the early 70s, he's been in Bologna, where he got a degree in philosophy, and where he had the chance to meet a fellow countryman, Ronald Stark, the mysterious spy figure, drug pusher, and, for a certain period, the cellmate of Renato Curcio, the leader of the Red Brigades. Ravarino's father was for years the director of Chase Manhattan Bank in Rome. His mother is a Macaferri, M-A-C-C-A-F-E-R-R-I, and neither Dave nor myself knows what that means. Returning to the narrative, Ravarino is certainly a collaborator of the American Secret Services. We hear him say, quote, I pick up the telephone and talk to Hugh Montgomery, already collaborator of the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Vernon Walters. I also talk to officials of the State Department and the CIA. I ask for and offer information. I receive bundles, unquote. In Italy, Ravarino collaborated with various newspapers. Often he managed to obtain exclusive interviews, one published in Panorama on May 17, 1987, with American billionaire Armand Hammer, the legendary business friend of Joseph Stalin, another used in Mondo Economico, July 30, 1988, with then-Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci. On top of that, he reported about an Italian-American magazine to the new president, George Bush. It was Ronald Reagan's White House successor who created the link between Ravarino and Gelli. It went this way, recounts Ravarino, quote, from the United States, I had heard that some American newspapers, from Washington Post to the Christian Science Monitor, had wanted to interview Licio Gelli because Bush, before he became president, had sent the Grand Master a little thank you note for his help during the electoral campaign. It was the summer of 1988, and if the U.S. press had come out with any connection between Gelli and Bush, it would have caused unimaginable damage. I then wrote Gelli a letter advising him to decline the invitations of the American newspapers, a suggestion that he later followed. So apparently, at least according to this information, there was information about a Gelli-Bush collaboration in the electoral campaign. That appears to be 1988. Recall that before we took a look at in information in Radio Free America 34, we took a look at information very closely linking George Bush and Licio Gelli. And one stated that Bush helped Licio Gelli when he was on the lam. Now, this Ravarino fellow has certainly dropped a lot of names, and some of it may be puffery. It's interesting that he hooks up with Ronald Stark. Ronald Stark is the probable U.S. intelligence agent who was the world's largest LSD manufacturer and who figures prominently not only in Radio Free America number 28, but also in the book Acid Dreams, co-authored by Martin Lee and Bruce Schlain. It's interesting, too, that Ronald Stark was run by DEA agent Thomas Angioletti, last name A-N-G-I-O-L-E-T-T-I, the same fellow who also not only ran but channeled morphine base to the late Henry Arsan, the late head of STBOM. So, again, make of this last article what you will. There's a lot of name-dropping, much of it quite possibly true, some of it possibly puffery, but the Gelli-George Bush link has come out in a lot of different ways. Here's more information about it, possibly. Some of this may not pan out, but that basically is why the Pizza Connection 4 case was so very, very, very explosive. We're going to take a short musical break. I'm going to come back and read one or two more things. We might even have time for about, 15 minutes of phone calls or so this evening. So, bit of musical break and then back again with a little more info. Once again, welcome back to the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. Well, very briefly, I'm going to read a very important piece of information. This will be stuck back into the archives, but I have now obtained more of the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators report. This comes courtesy of the Los Angeles office of the Christic Institute. And interestingly enough, as I suspected, the source for this information, although obviously they're not named by name, but they're all very reliable, and if anything, they're going to err on the side of conservatism, because obviously this is from Western intelligence sources. On pages 5 and 6 of the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators report, we find the following. Our sources are, by the way, this was written by a former Mossad agent who was the investigator. Our sources are and must remain confidential. However, before starting our findings, and in order to provide you some basics for estimating their accuracy, it is useful to first classify our sources generically and to rate them as to their respective reliability. We rate them not as to their organization's capabilities for general intelligence, but as to intelligence concerning terrorism. Sources. Source 1 is comprised of 6 persons working in different units of the intelligence community of a Western government. Reliability of this information is very good. Generally, this group of agencies is only fair to good among the various persons reporting based on our prior experience and its past record. However, the very number of separate sources in these agencies, not necessarily sympathetic to each other, all sharing the conclusion as well as the depth of the intelligence gathered, and the agency's considerable resources and special interest in the matter justifies rating this information as very good. Source 2 is comprised of 3 persons working in different units of the intelligence agency of a second Western government. Reliability of this information is very good, not so much due to prior experience with the source, which is good to very good, but because of their position to know the particular facts. Source 3 is 1 person working for the intelligence agency of a third Western-oriented government. Reliability of this information is excellent based on our prior experience with both the agency and the particular person, its and his prior record, and its position to know firsthand these matters. Source 4 is 1 person working for the intelligence agency of a fourth Western government. Good. It is normally rated very good, but is conservatively downgraded as to this matter because its information seems in some aspects to be derivative, i.e. in great part based on information received from other agencies. It must be emphasized that these sources did not have as their objective the acquisition of evidence for the apprehension and trial of the perpetrators. Rather, their objective is to monitor terrorist acts, draw conclusions based on their expertise, and then use what they learn so as to defend their countries in the future. Source 5 is an experienced director of airport security for the most security-conscious airline. He was in a position to receive the inside consensus of various security officers at Frankfurt Airport, which he reported to us. He also receives daily terrorism intelligence from his company's liaison with its host country's highly regarded intelligence service, and that's not in here. The rest is not in here. I don't have the next page. In any event, that's basically where this information comes from. Now, if you would like to obtain the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators report, or at least what I have of it, and I guess maybe I'm going to have to get this information here to our public service director, but send a stamped self-addressed envelope to the attention of the public service director and include a check for however much you would like to donate. This is so we don't take a loss here at KFJC. We don't ask for money, but it's not fair for us to take a loss in providing this information to you. So send a stamped, self-addressed envelope plus a check to the Public Service Director, or the Public Affairs, send it to the Public Service Director, okay? Make it Public Affairs Director. That's what. Senate Public Affairs, not Public Service. Public Affairs Director, KFJC-FM, 12345 El Monte Road. That's in Los Altos Hills, 94022. Once again, to the Public Affairs Director, KFJC-FM, 12345 El Monte Road. That's in Los Altos Hills, zip code 94022. And we will send you the send a stamped self-addressed envelope plus a check, and we will send you the We will send you the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators Report. Well, basically, we've got about 15 minutes, and what I'm going to do is open up the phones. We do not have Toy Boat. We do not have as much time as I'd hoped this evening. Let's go to our first call. Good evening, Oakland. Welcome to One Step Beyond.
Good evening. Wanted to call your attention to an article that was in the Bay Guardian of December 6th. It's called Flight 103, The Other Story.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it talks mainly about the Pan Am Insurance Investigators Report and basically puts in print most of the information that you've been giving out over the radio on this subject. Anyway, there's some new information in here that you haven't had on your show that I thought I should pass on, and I had a question.
Okay.
They say the traffic report was prepared by Interfor Incorporated, a New York-based anti-terrorism consulting firm headed by Israeli intelligence agent Yuval Aviv. And I was curious if you knew anything about that organization.
No, that is the name that I've seen in regard to the insurance investigators report, though. Mossad
okay.
Agent.
And mm-hmm. then also... they had some more information here. I think whoever authored this article might have had more than just the five pages. But anyway, they say after the accident, the FBI went to Army Major Charles McGee's house to mm-hmm. see his mother to ask if her son had left any packages with her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because they were concerned about, you know, what he might have sent back. And then they also say that shortly after the crash, a CIA team landed a helicopter near Lockerbie, and a suitcase was recovered, apparently with the approval of British intelligence and Scotland Yard.
There is an account of that in a book, a new book, a paperback, about the bombing of 103 that I have yet to obtain. I've been told about it. It's just that between one thing and another, I have not gotten down to do my book shopping. But that is information which has come out and which I hope to have for you next week.
Anyway, it's a good summary, and it details all the players in this scheme, gives a little a biography of each participant, you know, including Manzur al-Kassar, and pretty much debunks the two TV specials that went out last week, or was it the week before?
Good, good. Listen, I wonder if I could have you do two things for me. First of all, quickly repeat the date of the Bay Guardian article, and I wonder if I could also prevail on you to copy it and send it to me.
Okay, I could do that.
If you would do both, please.
Yeah, it's in the Bay Guardian of December 6th. The article's Flight 103, The Other Story. Did the CIA ignore warnings that a bomb was aboard Pan Am Flight 103 to protect a drug smuggler? And it's authored by Eric Anderson.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, there's some more information. And again, moving more towards reality than at least those two specials did, although I suspect that to say that they ignored the bomb is to overlook the fact that they probably arranged for it to be put on in order to silence the McKee team.
Right.
But anyway, that's you know, my inference from the events. But again, I think it's worth noting the sources that group relied on, because obviously, if anything, they're going to err on the side of conservatism. This is not a bunch of fly-by-night liberals. It's, you know, it's heavy Western intelligence sources.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
Thanks so much for your contribution.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.